Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour of our program today, our guest is Lieutenant General William Odom. He is a senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Hudson Institute's Washington, D.C. office. He is also an adjunct professor at Yale University. Between 1985 and 1988, he served as director of the National Security Agency. From 1981 until 85, he was Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence. That's the Army's senior intelligence officer. Before that, he was military assistant to the President's Assistant for National Security Affairs, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And as a member of the staff of the National Security Council, he worked on a number of issues, including strategic planning, Soviet affairs, and nuclear weapons policy. He's the author of a number of books. The most recent, in fact, one we discussed here on this program, was published in 1998 by Yale University Press. That book is The Collapse of the Soviet Military. And he's written articles for many different publications, including Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, Washington Quarterly, Military Review, and does a lot of interviews as well on these various issues. He's going to be in Champaign-Urbana on the U of I campus for a couple of events. Tomorrow, one Saturday, dealing with issues of nuclear proliferation and U.S.-Russia relations. A little bit later on in the program, I'll give you some more information on those because they're open to the public and anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Here this morning, there are a number of things we'll be talking about, of course, questions will be welcome here as well. If you're listening here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL. That's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters on the phone. And the toll-free line is 800-222-WILL. At any point, people are welcome to call and ask questions. General Odom, hello.
Yes.
Thank you, sir, for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure.
I wonder if first I might draw on your experience in intelligence gathering. After the attacks, the hijackings and the attacks that took place a month ago, perhaps the lead question on everyone's mind was why we didn't have some warning that this plot was underway. We seem to believe that, in fact, this had been in the planning for some time, and it seemed to be a pretty spectacular failure of intelligence that we didn't have some warning that, in fact, that it was going to take place. And I know this is a difficult question, but if I asked you why it was we didn't know, what went wrong, what sort of answer might you give?
I would give two primary answers, and I wouldn't consider them to be complete at all. But I think both of them will identify problems that have been with us and we ought to fix. The first is that we fell into the habit a long time ago. I don't know when it began, but I know in the 1980s when I was both Chief of Army Intelligence and the Director of NSA, leaks were hurting our intelligence collection rather seriously. And there is a very solid statute called the Communications Intelligence Act. But the administration, the Reagan administration, would never act on it, and I don't think any administration since then would act on it. And you don't even have to be a member of the government to be prosecuted by this. It says simply that if you disclose information about signals intelligence or any information collected that way, you can be convicted of a felon and a felony. And we just saw over that period a lot of key sources in the Middle East dry up. We also saw a lot of our publications, British and American newspaper articles about this, were circulated among embassies and other people's other organizations in the terrorism business to warn them. So I think there's been a general degradation because we've just been too loose with who knows about it and how available it is. And you can see in the events leading up to this, the administration warned that there would be an operation somewhere and it was supposed to be out in the Middle East. A lot of forces were put on alert out there, this, that, and the other. What that suggests to me is that Bin Laden and was probably assisted by some state intelligence operation out there as well as his own. But they have learned how the system works, and they've learned to deceive it, confuse it, mislead it. So I think on the foreign intelligence collection part, that would be part of the problem. Of course, I'm sure another part of the problem is we just don't have enough assets and we haven't worked on it hard enough. Now, there's another side of this. It has to do with counterintelligence and the FBI and border control. You probably, if you follow the news reporting on this, realize that there was a fair amount of information available from the movement of the terrorists, but it never got to anybody who was sufficiently alert to do anything about it or was in a position to do anything about it if they did have it. And there are two problems. Let me try to clarify them here. The first problem is, even if we'd had warning, it was hard to get it out to the right people. There are at least nine, perhaps five or six more, federal agencies with strong authorities on the border. They have something to say about the border. The consular service issues visas to get in. Immigration and Nationalization is a key border control agency. The Customs Service is a key border control agency. The Coast Guard, and on and on. They are spread over five cabinet departments. The idea that they would coordinate and talk to each other is too fanciful to even take seriously. We are in desperate need of a cabinet-level consolidated border control department that takes all those little things and puts them together. Only then could we ever get an information technologies system that would allow them to communicate effectively in this regard. So that's the first half of the problem. The second half of the problem is that the FBI has notoriously forever been poor at counterintelligence. The NKVD, that was the predecessor to the KGB, during World War II and after, ran over J. Edgar Hoover's organization like an NFL football team would run over a Division III college football team. And we're seeing that increasingly from the documents that are being released from Russia of the Soviet period. There are a couple of books from Yale Press in particular that have shown this. One, The Secret World of American Communism. Another one, The Soviet World of American Communism. The Communist Party was clearly a major front for these intelligence operations, and Hoover's organization just wasn't up to it. So when you see the Hansen case, and you see these other cases, this is not some big strange change. This is sort of business as usual. Now, I think the reasons for that are that when you mix law enforcement with counterintelligence, you don't get good counterintelligence. And I think that's one problem. Another problem is the way that the FBI has responsibility for it in the U.S. The military services have it each for their own services. The CIA has it for itself abroad. There is no comprehensive single counterintelligence picture, and the parochial advocacy of these agencies won't allow it to happen, and particularly the FBI has been bad in that regard. So I think the FBI needs to be taken out of counterintelligence and left in law enforcement, and under the director of Central Intelligence, a new organization which would take that piece of the FBI should be created, a National Counterintelligence Service, and give it operational control so it can look into the Army, Navy, Air Force, CIA, and any other counterintelligence activity so we get a comprehensive picture. And then we get people whose business is not crime and law enforcement, but whose primary concern is counterintelligence. And it takes a different mindset, it takes different approaches, it takes different intellectual capabilities to go after the spies and the penetrators of a foreign government or foreign terrorist organizations than it does to catch criminals. And until we do that, I don't think we'll have the information that's necessary, that would be useful or proper, to alert a border control department. So it's kind of complicated, but you ask a question that I hope that Tom Ridge, the new Homeland Defense chief, takes into account, and that in the stirrings that are going on here, we see some positive action on.
There, I think you point at what is probably his greatest challenge. That is that there are so many different branches of government with different responsibilities that all fit together as various pieces of this big puzzle, and that somehow they've got to learn to work together a little bit better, or there's got to be someone who is in a position of coordinating their efforts, bringing together what they know. It seems that that it's an almost impossible task.
I agree with that. I've often jokingly said, but it isn't entirely a joke, when people say, we really have to put somebody in control. We need a mechanism that makes sure that one person is in charge of counterterrorism. And my point has always been, well, you can do that. It just requires that we revoke the Constitution. We're a federal state, and the authorities for crime and law enforcement, which terrorism in the United States is a crime, and so every police service in the whole U.S. has that responsibility, and we can't put a single person in charge. The founding fathers designed it so we can't do it that way. We can greatly improve how we operate, though. And the reason I focused on the border, that is an area where fragmentation could be overcome by centralization in a federal department, and you don't interfere with the constitutional or federal arrangements at all in that regard. You just overcome this legacy of fragmented institutions from 19th century U.S. federal developments.
I think there's something else that has been pointed out as a problem, and actually I think that you touched on it, and that is particularly since the end of the Cold War, we have put fewer and fewer resources into human intelligence gathering. That is, I guess, what in plain language would be spies, agents, human beings on the ground in places where we're trying to learn about what's going on there. We put a lot of emphasis on spy satellites and computers and electronic intelligence gathering, and not so much on the legwork on the ground that in a situation like this, where we're trying to get information about small organized groups of people, semi-independent groups that are difficult to penetrate. Here, we don't really have the assets that we really need to get the information on them.
There's truth to that. I agree fully that we haven't put enough effort into human intelligence in that area, and the people in the human clandestine service would agree with you on that. I think it's a false trade-off to talk about putting too much into technical intelligence and not enough into human. We haven't put enough of the right kind into technical. Another reason for the surprises is that the nature of telecommunications is changing radically, and we have underinvested on a modernization of the technical intelligence capabilities. So we're hurting very seriously there. But you're exactly right on the human intelligence. Comparatively speaking, human intelligence is very cheap. I don't think it's so much getting the resources as it is leadership focus saying that we're going to make this a high-priority target. We're going to really go into this area. I mean, organizations and people in them respond to incentive structures. And if you get promoted by going out and do that, a lot of people will try to go do it. That hasn't been a high-payoff career path.
It seems interesting what's happened with the National Security Agency within the last few years, and that is this body that was previously one of the most secret, closed branches of the government, entities in the government, has, at least to some extent, opened itself up, perhaps because they are interested in building a constituency, and that knowing that in future down the road there might be less money going into defense in general or in intelligence, they wanted to make sure that some people actually knew who they were and what they were doing to make the case that it was important that they continue to have funding. What likely now is going to happen? I guess we should expect that certainly the NSA is going to stay around. Will the NSA get more money now?
Well, you raise a sensitive topic for me because I don't want to comment too strongly one way or another on my successors, and I think the present one is a very able man, but some of the things he's done are extremely important. I must say I in principle don't agree with the strategy of trying to build a constituency. I think that is a hopeless and unfruitful tactic for any intelligence service. And I think NSA is going to regret that, and they're going to, I think they're already probably going to suffer over it. With Puff Pieces saying how great they are, they don't look very good after what just happened. That's got to be terribly embarrassing. You know, it makes Pearl Harbor look small. Now, having said that, the right constituency for getting money for intelligence is the President, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, and the chiefs of the military services. They are the customers that use this, and if you do a good job for them, they're going to want to give you resources. I suspect they're going to get a lot of resources now because the military services, Secretary of Defense, the state, the president, all desperately need for them to be more successful. So the issue you raised, it's interesting. Very few people put it quite the way you did, but I think you're right on target. This goes back to the formation of the committees, the oversight committees on the Congress. That's when the CIA really began to try to develop a public constituency. The FBI has always had a public constituency. It's been the most effective, and look at what its internal performance has been. It seems to me there's almost an inverse relationship between the good publicity for an intelligence organization and its effectiveness.
Perhaps at this point I should reintroduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We're speaking with Lieutenant General William Odom. He has served as director of the National Security Agency. This was between 1985 and 1988. He also held the posts of the Army's senior intelligence officer. He was as well a member of the National Security Council staff under Zbigniew Brzezinski. This was from 77 to 1981. He is now senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Washington, D.C. office of the Hudson Institute. He is also adjunct professor at Yale University. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. I wonder if we might shift our focus a little bit and talk about the role of the military, that is, in terms of its mission. I think that after the Cold War, defense planners in the Pentagon and other people in Washington were starting to talk about a new mission for the military. And for a while, it seemed that one of the key points was that this feeling that the military should be able to fight two major wars at the same time. And the theoretical enemies were North Korea and Iraq. More recently, it seems that we're backing away from that idea that we should have to do that. And in fact, now the most recent quadrennial review has come out, and that it seems indeed officially now we're saying that while we have to be able to fight two regional wars, we only have to decisively be able to win one of them. And now, in light of what happened a month ago, they're also saying that one of these conflicts, in fact, could be a global campaign against terrorism. What do you see as the role for the military in this area?
Well, the discussion in the Pentagon about the two war strategy is somewhat artificial and misleading. The problems of programming forces to have them available are more manageable if you can just assume, for planning purposes, I want to be able to do X. The probability that those contingencies you're planning for are actually going to happen may be practically zero. The real question is whether you develop enough capability so that you have, for the president, the flexibility to handle a range of surprises that may face him. So it's not so much whether you have a two-war strategy or not. It's whether you have the capabilities to deal with the uncertainties and the certainties with regard to threats and problems you're dealing with. I think a major misunderstanding or failure in understanding in the Defense Department and its leadership under the certainly under the Clinton administration, it looks like to some degree it's persisting under this administration, is that they don't realize that the end of the Cold War did not eliminate their military responsibilities in Europe and Northeast Asia. All during the Cold War, U.S. forces in Germany not only kept the Soviet Union deterred from coming west, but it also made the Germans, the British, the French, and other West Europeans willing to trust each other. If you want to understand that role in the Far East, look at the public opinion polls in South Korea. During the 80s, and then during the 90s, it's remained the same. When South Koreans are asked what is the major military problem facing their country, in the 80s, they did not cite the Soviet Union. They did not cite North Korea. They cited Japan. Well, why don't they have war with Japan? Because U.S. troops are in both countries. The collapse of the Soviet Union hasn't changed that. So those forces there are providing a kind of security umbrella that keeps stability and lowers the transaction costs for international business, local business, and I think contributes to the prosperity in that region. I think exactly the same thing is true in Europe. Now people say, whoa, no, in Europe that's not true. They wouldn't fight each other. Well, let me give you an example, two or three examples, of why that may be too hasty a judgment. In 1994, the British Foreign Secretary was reported to have said, after his anger over German recognition of Croatia, it would be better to have the Russians on the Adriatic than the Germans. That does not show a high level of trust. Let's suppose in 1990, the U.S. had almost no troops in Germany, because the Cold War was essentially over, and the CFE treaty was being signed and all that, and the President Bush had tried to push ahead with German reunification. Maggie Thatcher was adamantly opposed to it. So was Mitterrand. The reason they had, both of them, had to concede to Bush in the change of NATO strategy, which was essential to get this concession, get this agreement from the Russians, was that the U.S. just had more military power. They didn't have much, so they had to do what we said. Now, suppose Maggie Thatcher had her way, and we had a divided Germany, and we didn't have any NATO into East Europe. What you see in Kosovo and Bosnia would be the case from the Baltics down to the Aegean. So U.S. forces there turn out to have a very important role now. Now, in addition to that, we have these other scenarios like Iraq, the one we're involved in now, and there could be two or three others. So the role of the U.S. military in the post-Cold War period is still much larger and more demanding than I think most people realize. Hmm.
It seems pretty clear that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld came into office with a mission, and the mission being to restructure the American military. How does the kind of military one needs if you're going to do the kind of war we were thinking about during the Cold War, how is that different from the kind of military that we think we need now?
Well, let me put this in kind of amusing terms and to sort of shock the audience, get their attention, folks. We have a fairly large maritime service, and we have cut our ground forces and our tactical air forces dramatically. The Army during the war against Iraq was over 900,000. Its normal level before that was nearly 800,000. Now it's down at 460-70. The Air Force has suffered an equivalent cut in wings and these sorts of things. The Navy hasn't had much cut at all. The Marines had virtually no cut. So we have very strong maritime forces which put us in charge of the porpoises and the whales while leaving the land to the tyrants for the lack of land forces. So we're very imbalanced in that regard. So I think if you take that as a focal point, you can see what needs to be done. We have a huge sunk cost in a blue water navy with no big new blue water navy to sink. And so what, you know, that doesn't, nuclear submarines don't contribute much to dealing with bin Laden or Saddam or anybody else. I wouldn't get rid of all of them, but we certainly are going to not need this big fleet for long time. That's also true with carrier-based air, which is hugely more expensive than land-based air. And now we can put land-based air almost anywhere. The carriers out supporting this operation in Afghanistan, their planes can hardly reach Afghanistan. We won't have real good tactical air on the ground there. I mean, operating intensively over sustained periods until you get ground bases. And I suspect the Uzbekistan and Pakistan bases are going to really greatly improve the amount of tactical air we'll have available. So we need that. Another thing that we're dramatically short of is airlift. The technological changes in airlift have been underappreciated by the military. A C-17 can carry an M1 tank. It can pick one up and with en route air refueling, carry it from here to Kuwait nonstop. A 300 of them could move all the tanks in a division in one load out there. So we haven't purchased that kind of airlift. Now, I think what we really need, if I were trying to describe in very simple terms, what the kind of capability, if the president and the secretary had this right now, they'd be in much better shape. If they had some years ago said, we want you, Army, Navy, and Air Force, to be able to project two heavy divisions to Europe in 2 weeks. You've got to get them over there in 2 weeks, and I want the first one on the ground in 5 days. If we had that capability, that would really sober people up. If you saw two heavy U.S. divisions move all the way across the ocean or into Persian Gulf region or to Korea, this is something dramatically new. Another capability we need is long-range forced entry. And I suspect you may see something like this in Afghanistan, where essentially you're using long-range airlift to do some kind of special operation like that. Those two things are capabilities that would hugely enhance our ability to deal with problems that we face in the world today. There is a third capability that we need, and I call it performing the military governance role. I don't see anything wrong with having troops in Kosovo and Bosnia and Macedonia and those places. That's a very good investment. It's much better than pulling out and saying we don't have anything to do this and then having it slowly burn into an all Balkans general war. Having our troops sit on these situations to provide stability has paid us handsomely in Korea, Japan, Germany, and elsewhere during the Cold War. And that's going to continue to be the case in places like the Balkans. We can't do that everywhere, but the Balkans are in Europe, and Korea is in an important part of Northeast Asia. I don't call it peacekeeping. I call it providing effectively the military governance umbrella under which stability can be maintained, liberal democratic institutions can be rooted.
We have less than 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our conversation with General William Odom will continue in a moment. I do want to mention, as I said at the beginning of the program, that General Odom will be here to take part in two events, one tomorrow and one Saturday on the U of I campus. The first is on Friday afternoon at 1:30. This is a panel discussion, Unblocking the Impasse on Nuclear Arms Control, and this is sponsored by the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, and will take place in the International Studies Building on the U of I campus. The other is a current affairs forum looking at the relationship between Russia and the United States. This is taking place on Saturday in the Law School Auditorium on the U of I campus from 10 in the morning to 1:30 in the afternoon. There are a number of sponsors, including the Arms Control Program, but also the Russian and East European Center, International Programs and Studies, the European Union Center. These events are open to the public, and anybody who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. Again, our guest this morning, William Odom, is a senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Washington, D.C. office of the Hudson Institute. He's also adjunct professor at Yale University. He was, from 1985 until 1988, director of the National Security Agency. He also served as the Army senior intelligence officer and was a staff member of the National Security Council. This was at the time that Zbigniew Brzezinski was the president's national security advisor. Questions welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a caller to talk with here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I had a comment and a couple of questions for the general. I would say, first of all, I think that you're slightly overstating this trust in Europe. I think if they didn't trust each other, then why several years ago were they talking about forming a European defense force as things seemed like they needed NATO less and less, and the U.S. was in a kind of a, I wouldn't say an isolationist direction, but it just, the Europeans were talking about forming their own defense force so they didn't have to rely so heavily on U.S.-backed forces in NATO. So I think the level of trust is a lot higher than you make it seem. I mean, I'm not arguing against the ability to project force abroad, but I think Europe doesn't need our forces to ensure stability, at least Western Europe. My questions would be, one, why do you think there hasn't been, maybe I'm missing it, but there doesn't seem to have been much talk about the possibility of including Russia in NATO eventually. As NATO continues to sort of gobble up, for lack of a better word, Eastern European and other European nations, I think the Russians will get increasingly nervous, as anyone who's a student of history of the last century realizes. They are very nervous about being isolated. That's the whole reason that they took so much territory after World War II and built that buffer zone. If we start doing the same thing, isn't there a potential for a large amount of nervousness on the Russian side? So why do you think that, I mean, I don't see why we couldn't include them in NATO. I mean, it is a collective security alliance, and we could sort of, I mean, I know you have the issues around the Balkan countries and some Eastern European countries, but we've had that issue to a lesser extent with Turkey and Cyprus and Greece. So I think within the structure of the organization, we could probably work around most of those problems. And the other question is, I'm glad you pointed out the whole two-front war thing, which I recall was a production of a paper, a white paper, I think, by a Democratic senator or rep back in the 90s when I was in grad school. I don't remember his name, but it was exactly as you described it, a recommendation for a force structure, not so much as strategic doctrine that we had to focus on North Korea or wherever. But in the future, do you think we will need so much more ground personnel and, say, tactical ground strike aircraft, as you talk about, when if one of the problems we face is terrorism, in which case this is, I can't conceive of an operation larger than the one we have going on now, and it seems that we have sufficient capabilities to deal with that, although they may not be in place. You really think we need more of those types of capabilities to deal with terrorist incidents around the world? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. General Odom?
First, on trust in Europe, I just invite you to look at what has happened at the so-called European Security Defense Initiative. They've talked a lot about it, but they put almost no money in it. And the more they've talked about it, the greater the decline in their defense budgets has been. Part of the talk is, I think, was a reaction against the Clinton's administration, its unwillingness to put troops on the ground in the war against Serbia in 1999. But the issue had come up earlier than that, and the French lead it. The French are very ambivalent. On the one hand, they would like to get us out of Europe. On the other hand, they're scared to death to let Germany run Europe, which will be the case. Joschka Fischer said very clearly, and he said it's my private view, but he then pointed out that there will be no European defense capability, or they're not going ahead with the political integration unless there's a federation. And the reaction to that in Europe was hostile to Fischer. The French just absolutely blew it away. This is just out of the question. So if you follow the other things that are going on, I think you'll put this so-called common defense and security policy into a clearer perspective. On Russia, we have membership action plan requirements to join NATO. If we applied those to Russia and said, okay, you can come on in, and if you're a serious student of political development and economic transformation, I think you'd see straight away that Russia is probably not going to meet those requirements in the next 30 years. So, in principle, I'm not going to object to Russia making that transformation and joining the Western community of liberal democratic nations. I would applaud that, welcome that. Realistically, that's not going to happen in my lifetime. I doubt it's going to happen in your lifetime. A Russia that came in with exceptions that didn't have to do that would essentially destroy the NATO system. And that, I'm sure, some Russian leaders would like to see happen. And then if you know the interwar period in Europe, we could get back to that and have a lot of instability and slowly choose up sides and have another big war in Europe. So an early admission of Russia to NATO is a formula for destabilizing Europe, not stabilizing it. The issue of whether Russia is going to recover and be angry and fight back, I don't think Russia is going to recover. It's a different situation now, and that's a longer issue, and I can't talk about that in detail right now. But let me go to your final point about whether we need more ground forces. The point is we cut our ground forces hugely. And the answer is yes, we're going to need more of them. And we cut them too severely in Europe before the war, after the Cold War. Let me give you an example. If we're going to bring these countries effectively into NATO, Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and maybe a few others if we admit them, training up their militaries and integrating them in the West is a key factor. And that has very strong binding political implications. So you want to do it not just to fight wars, but for its political consequences. That requires big U.S. forces there to run these exercises and train up those armies. The Partnership for Peace program, which I was not very enthusiastic about, I think I have been totally wrong about it. It's turned out to be a roaring success. But it has greatly overburdened our forces in Europe and their ability to handle all these programs. If you send 500 troops to Ukraine, it turns out there are 10,000 in the tail supporting it. And if you run 30, 40 of those exercises a year, then it keeps our troops out in the field all the time. The ordinary sergeant and captain and lieutenant are away from their families 9 months of the year in Europe because we're so shorthanded. And let me give you an example of why fighting terrorism will require it. We're not going to put a new government effectively into Afghanistan, which they seem to be inclined to do, without some U.S. troops on the ground. Afghanistan is not the last target in this. You can bet that some other countries are also harboring terrorists, and we're going to turn around and find ourselves having to do something about that. Let's suppose, just hypothetically, Iraq turns out to have supported bin Laden or gives him haven if he runs away from Afghanistan, or that we found out that Saddam was actually providing intelligence support. How are we going to take Iraq? It's going to take picked ground forces. We're going to have to take it, and this time we can't act like we did in 1991 and say we won and come home. You'll have to govern that country out there for 20 or 30 years. So that the upcoming requirements of ground forces, I don't want to exaggerate them, but they're not small. And there's a tendency to kind of think that we can sit here in the United States as a great, wealthy country and not have heavy military responsibilities in the world. I call it just the transaction costs we pay for doing business in this world and being very, very wealthy. Again, as a percentage of our GDP, as a percentage, as a real level of force, it's pretty small. It's in the 3% range of the GDP. It's not anywhere like the manpower levels in the Cold War, which certainly didn't bankrupt us. So I think if we're kind of candid and clear-minded on this, it's doable, and I think most Americans will be quite willing to support it.
We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less. We have several callers. We'll try to get as many as we can in the time that remains. Next in line is Chicago, and then is line number 4. Hello.
Thank you. I really appreciate the insight you're offering to us here very, very much. But the matter of insight is something that's pretty short in the world picture. I would like to go back to a comment President Roosevelt made at the time of the changeover from Chiang Kai-shek and the onset of Mao Zedong's presence. And he sought out the advice that might shed some intelligence upon the situation then. And who did they have to turn to? There were missionaries.
I'm having trouble hearing you. Could you...
Oh.
What is the case you're referring to?
Well, I talked about insight and intelligence, and referring to President Roosevelt back at the time of the changeover from Chiang Kai-shek to the advent of the presence of Mao Zedong.
Yeah, but Roosevelt was dead then.
Well, and he sought the advice of Mr. Casey, and the matter was left to the knowledge we knew about Mao Zedong and others. From the information we could gather from missionaries. So the shortcoming on our intelligence quotient was very, very apparent way back then and even going back to other times.
Right.
We also have the fact that in terms of finance, how much better off would we have been if we had expanded our diplomatic, civil, and commercial relationships with countries in lieu of the fact that we have spent something like $6 trillion in armament alone in this country since the Second World War up until the middle of the 1990s. So I can see where we're willing to spend a lot for that, but we should certainly spend more in intelligence and wisdom gathering like you are benefiting us, and certainly we should follow through in developing closer relations in the area of trade and so forth, which will be put the fact of... the folly and irony of war. In the Japan and Germany were our enemies, and now they're our allies and cooperative and more harmonious in our relationships. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any comment you want to make on that?
Well, I would just make a brief comment that I certainly would support the idea of having as much insight and intelligence as we can in analysis. But I reject outright the proposition that you can prevent war by trade. You know, the peace movement and the British and in Great Britain all during the 19th century paddled that line all over and over again. John Stuart Mill was a great proponent of it. It's just never been the case. And countries that trade with each other are quite capable of fighting. And, in fact, trade sometimes can even inspire wars. So the question is not one or the other. The question is whether you provide security that facilitates trade that doesn't lead to war, and I think the trillions of dollars we've spent have allowed us to make many, many times more trillions of dollars in increased growth through international trade. The record of U.S. expanding trade in the post-war period is wholly unprecedented in history. So if you think that you have a program for improving on that by suspending, cutting back the military... I don't find that a credible argument, and it's not a proposition I really want to test.
Let's go to another caller here, Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hi. Well, I don't think it was an argument that he was making, actually, because he was very complimentary of your basic realpolitik analysis, which I completely take issue with.
Well, and then I apologize to him.
Yeah, you can disagree with me.
Okay.
Not him, I think. I don't think trade is a solution. I think maybe if more countries had boycotted the Nazis in the 30s and not participated in the militarization of Japan like the U.S. did, then maybe something could happen on a longer range. But actually, you're talking about Russia being kept out of NATO and taking 30 years. It struck me as, Turkey apparently has already done what it's needed to do, which is to solve their Chechnya problem, which is, i.e., the Kurds, by just obliterating them. And that, I guess, the credential that allows us to ask them to help out in Afghanistan, which apparently we're going ahead with, that is the Turkish military, is good enough to be part of NATO. I don't know if you see the meta level that I'm arguing. It's outrageous that Turkey can be let in and Russia can't. I mean, we need Turkey, actually. That's why they're let in, and that's why it's nothing to do with their credentials as democracy or representative government. It's what you were saying earlier, which you were shocking through the morning, actually. I don't think anybody's out there sleeping after you saying that, you know, it's really military might. It's really what the U.S. does to what we need to coerce Europe, basically. This is what's that got to do with representative government?
Well, let me say I understand your perplexity over the Turkey and the Kurds. That's been a difficult issue for U.S. policy, and we have a number of relationships in the world where those kind of contradictions are serious and strong, and they always create tensions between us and those countries, and there's just not a clean-cut, easy choice there that meets all the moral requirements most of us would like to meet. And so I understand exactly what you're saying there. I think making the parallel between Russia and Turkey is a little overdrawn, and I didn't rule out Russia. But
just said it would take 30 years for them to get in, whereas Turkey was let in quite a few years ago because, as I say, it's got nothing to do with representative
government. Turkey did have, Turkey has had representative governments, elections. You know, look back at what happened to Turkey. You had Ataturk, who took it from being a radical Islam, rather from being a purely theocratic country under the Ottomans, into a secular society. In other words, Turkey is the hope for Islamic societies if they want to have secular governments and at least try to become democratic. They have a representative government that works occasionally, and then periodically the military have intervened briefly, and then they've gone back to it. Would you just totally abandon them and say, we're not going to encourage that kind of effort to struggle forward at all? No, I don't think we should. I think the same thing about Russia. I'm just trying to be realistic about it. I'm absolutely supportive of transition efforts in Russia. The forces obstructing that internally in Russia are not just the minorities like the Chechens. That's not the problem. It's the big bureaucracies of the old Soviet regime that are still around. It's the generals who don't want to give up their positions and cut the forces. It's the recruitment system that brutalizes Russian soldiers in military service. It's all sorts of kinds of things you could expect that would get in the way of a smooth transition to Russia. I can't make those go away by just sort of changing U.S. policy. And I said at some point, I don't have any problem with Russia coming in. The question is, can they even get to the Turkey level in the next 10 or 20 years?
I'm going to have to jump in at this point. My apologies to the caller and to the other person we have a holding. We're just going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Well, I want to say to you, General Odom, thank you very much for giving some of your time today. We appreciate
okay.
it. Our guest, Lieutenant General William Odom, he's a senior fellow and a director of the National Security Studies at the Hudson Institute's Washington, D.C. office. He's also adjunct professor at Yale University and will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois for a couple of talks this weekend, one Friday afternoon, 1:30 at International Studies on Nuclear Arms Control, and then Saturday morning starting at 10 at the law school in their auditorium, taking part in a discussion of Russian American relations.